I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Marcela Diaz. She is the executive director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido, which is an immigrant rights organization based here in Santa Fe, and Alma Castro, who is also with Somos Un Pueblo Unido. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
And I would like to welcome Manuel Antonio Esteves Rodriguez and Israel Garcia, who are going to tell us about some of their experiences with wage theft and retaliation. Bienvenido.
Gracias.
Now, let's talk, Marcela. Tell us about this whole issue. What's going on? What is wage theft?
Well, wage theft is an unfortunate problem in our city, in our state, and really across the country, Mary Charlotte. It is defined, or we define it as a non-payment or underpayment of wages to workers in our community. It is a crime that often goes unreported and unprosecuted for various reasons. And it basically occurs when employers don't pay the minimum wage, they don't pay overtime, they require employees to work off the clock, or they fail to disperse final paychecks. We've gotten over the years a number of complaints of people working long hours and just not getting paid. And so we decided, we have a really strong workers' rights project. A lot of people think that Somos is, you know, that we're only supporting laws that are favorable to immigrants, when in fact we're immigrant-based and we're promoting policies that are that promote racial justice and worker justice. And so a lot of the laws and policies we pass actually benefit low-wage workers across the board.
I was going to say, I mean, immigrants aren't the only people who might be victims of wage theft, working overtime and not getting your overtime and so on, but they're probably the most vulnerable because they're less likely to lodge a complaint. Is that true?
Well, when we have politicians continuing to promote anti-immigrant policies and laws across the board, and when we have such a nasty anti-immigrant rhetoric in the public discourse, it really does discourage people from speaking out when the rights that they do have been violated. And that doesn't just affect the immigrant worker, it affects all workers in the workplace, it affects their families, it affects their local economy, and it undercuts the businesses that are following the law. So it's really important that all workers, regardless of where they're from, get paid what they're owed and feel like there's an environment where this kind of wage theft is not tolerated. And that's really what Somos Un Pueblo Unido is working to do.
So Manuel, tell us your story. You worked at China Star.
Sí.
Yes, I did. I was a worker at China Star since 2008. I worked 2.5 years, working 11 and 12 hours daily.
And you worked 6 days a week?
Sí.
Yes, 6 days a week.
And you were not paid overtime, or what happened?
No,
they weren't paying me overtime or the minimum wage.
And so what did you do? Did you know that you were being underpaid?
Yes, but I was scared. I was afraid of making a complaint and they would retaliate against me.
And so how did you finally connect with the people of Somos Un Pueblo Unido?
So we saw them on TV that they had a campaign against wage theft, so we decided to go visit them.
Was this happening, as far as you knew, to other employees also at the China Star?
Yes, to all the employees that work for China Star.
And so what did you do? Did you file a complaint?
I put a complaint with New Mexico Workforce Solutions.
And what happened then?
Yes, we put in a complaint, and 3 days after we complained, they took our hours down from 12 to 6 hours.
And were you then being paid properly the minimum wage?
Yes, after we put in our complaint, they paid me $9.85 an hour.
Which was the proper wage. Now, what's amazing to me is when I found out about your story is that working 6 hours, you were bringing home the same paycheck as when you were working 11, 12 hours. Is that correct?
Sí.
Yes.
And so once you put in your complaint with the Department of Workforce Solutions, which is the New Mexico... Well, explain to us, Marcela, what is this department?
That is basically the Department of Labor, with a different name, Department of Workforce Solutions, and their wage and hour division is charged with, it's an administrative process to help individuals recuperate their stolen wages. And so they have a whole administrative process, if in fact they can prove that their wages have been stolen.
And so what happened then? I mean, were you successful in your complaint?
Oh, sí, cuando fuimos...
Yes, our complaint was taken by Workforce Solutions, and five workers of the China Star Workers Committee went in to testify, along with also other people who knew and had worked at China Star, but they only took the story from the five workers, and they didn't talk to any of our witnesses.
What do you mean by witnesses?
Otros amigos que habían sido
other workers that had worked at China Star but were no longer there but came to testify on our behalf.
Decidieron acompañarnos.
And so there were five people who were still working there who were basically, I mean, would you consider it a case of retaliation when their hours were reduced that much?
Sí.
Yes, all five of us.
And so how much money were you owed? In other words, you worked for, was it years?
I worked 2.5 years for the company, and they owe me approximately $59,000.
$59,000 in unpaid overtime.
And underpaid wages.
And underpaid wages. So
we did the calculation, and I think it came out to about between $4 and $5 an hour that these individuals were getting paid, which is far below the city minimum wage and below, clearly, the state and federal minimum wage.
Extraordinary.
And this is happening to a lot of workers. We held a press conference a couple of days ago, and there were about six different workers representing different workers' committees that were also in the midst of trying to recuperate stolen wages from various restaurants, a security company, cleaning services here in Santa Fe. And this is just a sampling of really what's going on. And this problem becomes exacerbated, Mary Charlotte, during tough economic times. You know, that this is how people are able to save money, but it really is affecting our employers, but it's really affecting our families because, you know, we've heard of people who have, you know, not been able to pay their rent, and so they end up becoming homeless. They have to go and take their family to live with family members, people who are having to rely on charitable services like the Food Depot or others because they didn't get paid what they were owed. And, of course, that means that they're spending less money in our local economy.
And who would be making a living and feeding their families and so on, even at the, I mean, in many people's view, relatively low wage of $9.50 to $10 an hour, they wouldn't need those services and they wouldn't be in that kind of trouble if their employees were paying them the legal wage.
Well, I think many of your listeners can probably understand what it means to live paycheck to paycheck. And so when you're living paycheck to paycheck and you're not actually getting paid for the hours you worked, then it's clearly very problematic for workers across the board in our city.
Did you get what you needed? In other words, did you get justice and compensation from the Department of Workforce Solutions?
No.
No, they didn't do anything in our case.
Why not?
Porque en ese tiempo ese
no, the, in the six-month period between the time that we put the complaint, China Star was able to go bankrupt, and Ernesto Padilla, who was the labor law administrator in the case, said there was nothing he could do after the bankruptcy.
And so what did you do next?
No, pues decidimos hacer una queja con...
So we put in a claim with the NLRB, which is the National Labor Relations Board, because they were treating people who had organized differently than those who hadn't.
Now, by workers' committees, basically what you mean, if I understand it correctly, is people who worked at a business and organized into groups that could then take these cases forward. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. When we're talking about workers' committees, at least what we're doing with Somos Un Pueblo Unido, they're informal groups of workers who have come together to complain about some of the problems that they have at their workplaces. Now, this falls under collective concerted activity that's protected under the National Labor Relations Act. And so we've had six successful NLRB, or National Labor Relations, cases on behalf of workers here in Santa Fe, and we continue to organize groups around the city and the state.
And where does your case with the National Labor Relations Board stand now?
Sí, está, por en este día teníamos
so
una corte
we were supposed to have a hearing this week for the National Labor Relations
una corte,
Board, but because
Ana Sue's
husband was sick, they postponed the hearing and we're still waiting.
It's, I think, important to note, Mary Charlotte, that the National Labor Relations Board intervenes in this because they acted in a concerted effort to try to change the terms and conditions of their employment and their wages and were retaliated against, and that's when they step in. They After the workers' committee complains, they follow up with an investigation, which happened, and if they find sufficient reason to believe that the National Labor Relations Act was violated, then they go ahead and put a charge in against the company, which is exactly what happened. So this is really far along the process. So the NLRB already believes, or the National Labor Relations Board believes, that there's sufficient evidence here to show that they were retaliated against for trying to basically get paid what they were owed collectively.
Now, apparently, I mean, the China Star has gone bankrupt, but they're reopening. Is that correct?
Well, we've heard that they're reopening under a different, that the same restaurant is opening, but under a different name. And so, of course, this is a tactic that a lot of employers will use. But the reason why we're sort of, we've launched this campaign to end wage theft and to really help folks understand what it is because we want to create an environment, again, that's intolerant of wage theft. We need businesses to stand up against this. We need a strong Department of Workforce Solutions that will actually follow up with these cases, that will go to court if necessary. They can go to magistrate court, they can go to district court. We need the Attorney General to step in if they go to district court and these cases are over $10,000. And we need to have a much stronger level of enforcement on this issue. It, again, is a crime, and it rarely, if ever, gets prosecuted as such.
Israel Garcia, you worked for a restaurant called Los Mayas. Tell us your story.
I worked for Los Mayas approximately 2 months. What was happening there was that our pay was extraordinarily late.
So you would work and not get a paycheck every 2 weeks?
Well, what happened was that we would go in and the pay would be late 5-6 days, and we would ask the secretary and she would say that there was no money and the business wasn't doing well, but we could see that every day they were full.
And when you got your paycheck, was it the right amount? Were you getting the minimum wage?
Yes, they paid us the minimum wage.
And so what was your complaint against Los Mayas?
We would continually wait for our paychecks and they were becoming later and later, and our wages were building up, and there was rumors that the business was going to close, and we were all scared that we weren't going to get paid our wages.
And is that what happened?
Yes, that's finally what happened, and we realized that the payments weren't going to get paid, so I decided to quit, and it ended up being 3 weeks that I wasn't paid.
And were you able to recover those wages?
Sí, porque pasaron los días en que no me pagaban, y yo llegaba y me decía hasta el fin que hablé con el dueño.
It took quite a while for me. I would go in and ask for my wages, and finally I spoke with the owner, Fernando, who said that he wasn't going to pay me until the following summer. So I decided to go to the Department of Workforce Solutions, but the process was very daunting. And the labor law administrator, Ernesto Padilla, said that it was going to take a long time for me to recover my wages.
El juez Ernesto Padilla dijo que el proceso era muy largo y había que esperar y tener paciencia, ¿va? Y entonces
And what happened after that?
Entonces pasaron las semanas y meses y
He finally came into the Department of Workforce Solutions and said that I needed to wait, that he couldn't pay me at that time, but really what he wanted was for the process to go so long that he would never have to pay any wages.
Lo que él quería era que el proceso se alargara para no querer pagar.
The labor law administrator asked me if I could wait and be patient, and I said yes, because he needed to pay me what I had worked.
Que él tenía obligación de pagarme las horas de trabajo.
And finally?
It took about 5 to 6 months for me to get paid my wages.
Now, was this a problem with other employees of that same restaurant?
El rumor sí estaba entre todos los compañeros porque
So yes, this has been the case with everybody who worked there. When I would go in to ask for my wages, people would laugh and say, "Are you here to ask for money too?" Because it was the culture of the restaurant that people were not getting paid, and I think there are a lot of people who have not been paid by this person.
Varios a los que se les debe y lastimosamente las personas no han querido actuar en contra de esta persona.
Mary Charlotte, there were two other people who did come in to Somos and we referred them to the Department of Workforce Solutions, they made complaints and were not paid and still to this day have not been paid. Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't take 5 to 6 months to get a paycheck for work that you've already done months prior. And so that's exactly the problem. This process needs to be a lot swifter. People need to be able to get to the Department of Workforce Solutions, make their complaints, you know, quick investigations, and people need to be able to recuperate their money.
And also, as we heard, Israel did get the wages that he was owed, but he didn't get any damages. The law that we passed in 2009 allows for treble damages, meaning three times what you're owed by the employer. That wasn't fought by the New Mexico Department of Workforce Solutions, and it hasn't been fought in a lot of cases, even though it's written into the law. We have two other cases at this same restaurant who have gone through the process. Fernando Antillas has been found guilty of wage theft, and he has not paid the workers.
And the Department of Workforce Solutions, which in theory, I mean, it's essentially the Department of Labor, what's going on? They're not defending workers? Isn't that what they're supposed to do?
Well, there are always a lot of problems. I mean, to be fair, there's, you know, these, there are few investigators. There aren't a lot of resources. But there are definite things that can happen at the Department of Workforce Solutions to help move these along. I mean, we've heard so many stories of people trying to call the investigator to get information about when it's going to happen, and they don't never get calls back. They're told in many cases they're discouraged from following the procedure. And here are two examples of folks who said this is going to be too long of a process, and it kind of wears people down. And so, I mean, this is going to take to really end wage theft. It's going to take a concerted effort on the part of the city, on the part of the Attorney General, and part of the Department of Workforce Solutions, and community and faith organizations need to step up to the plate as well. We work here locally with a new organization called Interfaith Worker Justice, which is rallying people in the faith community around this issue. This is actually National Week of Action Against Wage Theft, and this is a part of a national effort of organizations that are also a part of Interfaith Worker Justice based in Chicago to actually start talking about this issue. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to put a face to this issue and really show people that it is affecting our community in a very negative way.
I find it absolutely shocking that an employee would go to pick up their paycheck and have the administration say, oh, you want money? As if it weren't owed to them.
Definitely, and I think that this is a problem that a lot of people are seeing, not only in terms of wage theft, but in discrimination and issues of just being treated badly at work. That's why I want to take the opportunity to invite everybody to a workers' rights forum that we're going to have this evening at St. Anne's Church here in Santa Fe starting at 5:30. The Department of Labor is going to be there. The EEOC, which is Equal Opportunity Employment, will be giving presentations, as well as Somos Un Pueblo Unido and our workers' committee talking about how to organize. So I want to invite everybody, please, if you have any doubt what your rights are as a worker, or if you know anybody that could benefit, both English and Spanish speaking workers will have the opportunity to speak to these agencies, as well as attorneys who will be talking to people about their individual cases.
How widespread do you think this problem is here in Santa Fe?
Well, I think we get lots of complaints, so we're not sure how widespread it is, but we know that we continually get complaints. We get dozens of complaints. We've helped lots of groups probably recuperate about $400,000-$500,000 within the last few years. We were so concerned about the lack of protections in the law that the Workers' Committee of Somos Un Pueblo Unido decided to mount a campaign in 2009 to actually change state law, and they did so successfully. You know, when low-wage workers are not a part of a union, they know they're very vulnerable to a lot of different issues, not just wage theft, you know. And so this is just one piece of it, but we effectively changed the law to give some additional protections to workers. Right now, what we're seeing is problems in the enforcement of that law. And
yeah.
So that's why it's so important that we continue to put a face to this issue, continue to put pressure on the Department of Workforce Solutions, as well as other agencies, to really help folks recuperate these wages. We need to make examples of the unscrupulous employers who continue to use this as a tool to basically increase their bottom line. This is unacceptable.
There is this question of why they're doing it. I mean, there are certainly restaurants or other businesses who say, that they can't survive with the minimum wage law as it is and so on. But then there are other businesses, and that may or may not be true, and then there's other businesses who are bringing home a handsome profit that they're actually stealing from their lowest wage workers.
Definitely.
And to be fair, the majority of businesses are not stealing wages from their workers.
Yeah.
It is the unscrupulous employers that are doing that. But we need to take a stand against it as a community. It really does undercut the businesses that are following the rules.
For more information on this issue, ladies and gentlemen, you can go to SomosUnPuebloUnido.org. And if you go to SomosUnPuebloUnido.org, .org/wage theft. You can find out a lot more about this issue, and we will see you tonight at St. Anne's Parish Church, which is at 511 Alicia Street. It's next to the Tune Up Cafe on the corner of Alicia and Hickox, and it's a workers' rights forum and wage theft clinic. I want to thank Marcela Diaz, Executive Director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido, and Alma Castro from Somos Un Pueblo Unido, and Manuel Antonio Esteves Rodriguez and Israel Garcia. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Dee Dee Emmons. She's author of the new book, Wild Flavors, One Chef's Transformative Year Cooking from Eva's Farm. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
So you are in New England, you're in Massachusetts, and you met a woman who is, I guess, a legendary farmer in New England, is that right? Named Eva Somaripa. Who is she, and how did you meet her?
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up in New England, and I'm just thinking about New Mexico and how wonderful it would be if we could all be transported to Santa Fe. But I think that I met her, I first had heard about her for maybe 10 or 15 years when I was in my mid-20s. I was entering the Boston restaurant scene, and I had gone to French cooking school in Paris, and when I came back, I worked in the higher-end restaurants, and the chefs talked about Eva because they bought herbs and greens from Eva. But, you know, it was always in a way that kind of made me stand up and pay attention. It was like there was a hush-hushness about it because they couldn't order too much because it was very expensive. And also, I guess it was just intriguing to me. I'm not quite sure why, but Eva has a very strong relationship with her chef. So anyway, that's where I first got to know her. And then eventually I opened my own restaurant 15 years later, and she sent me a fax with a note in the margins. And she said, "Hi, Dee Dee, good luck. You know, wishing you all the best. Love, Eva." And I'm like, oh, my God, she doesn't know who I am, but now she does. Or how does she know me? And I was really excited, and so I called her.
And you opened your restaurant the same week that the Twin Towers were hit, the 9/11 week. And so that wasn't very good karma or whatever, good timing. But you ended up going down and spending time with this woman. And you call it extreme local food, like, you know, like extreme skiing. What did you mean by that?
Extreme local. Well, I think I meant that Eva's style of eating and living was extreme, like extreme skiing. And that's because she really doesn't eat beyond like maybe a mile of where she farms. So all of us are, you know, all of us good foodies are trying to eat more locally. But a lot of the times we can't control everything we eat. And with Eva, it's you open her refrigerator and there's not one label. There's not, she doesn't go to the supermarket, and she really hasn't been going to the supermarket for 20 years. She'll get toilet paper, but normally she gets people to go. She gets very confused at the supermarket. So, you know, the lights and the inventory, there's so many choices. She's the kind of person that just gets, you know, when she starts talking about something, she gets very focused, hyper detailed, and I think it just freaks her out, the supermarket.
Now, that can't be totally 100%. I mean, olive oil doesn't grow in New England or isn't made in New England, and, you know, rice and things like that. I mean, nobody eats really, really 100% locally, do they? Or certainly not she.
No, no. No, I think that I like to idealize her a little bit, but she has a good friend that works up at Cornell University, and he has an amazing farmer's market in Ithaca, New York, and she buys from him. She'll say, can you get me 50 pounds of brown rice and 50 pounds of wheat berries? And so she gets things in bulk from him. And the olive oil, yeah, like that's a really important part of her diet. She does get local butter, but the olive oil comes from some neighbors that are Italian that I know well now and have been to Italy with them. They import it from a town in Tuscany. So it's not local, but it doesn't go through the supermarket. So she does manage to not go to the supermarket, but she's not 100%. She's like probably 95%, you know, within a few miles.
So what was your relationship like? I mean, you went there once and it was a very busy day, and this is I don't know exactly how old she is now, but it seemed like somewhere in her 60s or 70s at the time. Highly, highly energetic woman doing 5 gazillion things at a time. And what became your place at her farm?
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. You know, what became my place at the farm? Is that what you said? Because, because that's sort of what happened. I mean, I found a place there. I drove up. I saw Eva standing there, and she looked, you know, frantic and crazed, and she was talking to a farmer, and I knew it was her when I saw her, and she gave me this warm welcome, but then 10 seconds later said, oh, but I'm so sorry, I can't deal with you right now, I'm in crisis, and I want you to just walk around. So I walked around, and she now has 10 greenhouses. She had 8 back then. But then there's also the fields where the majority of the plants grow. And after about 45 minutes, I had only gotten halfway through one greenhouse. And there were so many herbs that I had never tasted. And I was so excited. And I got out of the greenhouse and I, you know, like poked my head out. And I just looked around and I'm like, there's something here for me. I'm going to be part of this, or I'm going to get what I can out of this place. And I knew it was going to be like a long-term thing. I just knew it.
And so then you started just going and hanging out there and
kind of, yeah. I mean, you know, if I was a real journalist, I mean, I had written 2 books by that time, but I really didn't hang out to write about her. I hung out because it was just that tremendous. It's a small 2-acre farm, but she grows over 200 herbs and greens and weeds that she cultivates and foraged foods. So for me, it was just this Shangri-La, like it was a culinary Shangri-La. I just felt like, just the smell alone kept me there. And so I would go on the weekends, or I'd go once a month and try to grab a few days. She just put me up in her bed where one of her sons used to sleep, and the place is a little communal. I mean, I was always cooking for 5 or 10 people whenever I'd go down, and I was kind of like the resident chef. And there were other chefs doing the same thing too. So, you know, a lot of chefs would go there on their day off just to walk around and smell the smells and watch the hummingbirds and bees and enjoy the place. So she's very, very extroverted. So for her, I think the people coming in and appreciating her farm is as much a reason for her running her business as, you know, writing invoices and, you know, collecting money or whatever.
We're talking to Dee Dee Emmons about the new book, Wild Flavors. So one thing that was so interesting is that, I mean, there's sort of a cliche about how indigenous people use the whole animal. Well, this woman uses the whole plant, which I found really surprising and interesting. Give us some examples of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure that this happened back with Native American Indians or any people that didn't have access to processing and, mega agriculture. So an example would be cilantro, I guess. So cilantro, a plant has many life cycles. So in the baby stage, in the baby stage, it's very tiny. And in with that, she doesn't use that. But with many plants like kale or spinach, she harvests it at the baby stage. But cilantro grows and becomes the herb that we know, and that's one stage. And then it'll bolt, usually, and it'll produce kind of a ferny leaf. And Eva loves this stage also, and will sell it, and she understands the flavors. The flavors change as the plant matures, and so she'll sell chefs on this. And chefs nowadays just, love being educated by her, because it is so much a part of selling their food, is knowing their food and being a little different than the average Joe. But then the cilantro will flower. And this is also a beautiful stage where, you're getting a sweeter flavor from the nectar. And then the flower will form berries. These are cilantro berries that are very juicy, and the flavor really departs from what kind of we know of as cilantro, and it's somewhere between a curry flavor and a cilantro flavor. And then the berry will dry and harden and turn into a coriander seed, which is usually a principal ingredient in Indian curry powder. Oh, and then there's a cilantro root. The root itself is used in Southeast Asian curries, and she's now selling that to chefs as well. So that's just an example, but every plant that's edible has many edible stages, and the book really goes into that, because if you want to try your hand at gardening and growing a few of these herbs, it's worth, waiting for the flowers with, lemon balm, or with fennel, it's worth harvesting the seeds when they're green and sweet. And then I explain what you can make. I offer some recipes that that I've had success with. So that's what it's really about. The book's about 46 plants that are my very favorites and their whole life cycle.
And it's as much a recipe book as a narrative about your time on this farm. There's a whole section on eating flowers. What are some flowers that you eat, and how do you eat them?
Well, every edible plant, like even broccoli or cabbage, has edible flowers. And how do you eat them? Well, other herbs have very, very lovely tasting flowers, like pineapple sage flowers are red. They look like tall little baby bugles, and they are very, very sweet. So flowers in general are used in salads. They're very difficult to transport, so you really have to grow. You don't normally see them in supermarkets. Nasturtiums you might see, but even then, you have to have very experienced farmhands to know when to pick the nasturtiums or any flower, so that you have to pick them just as they open, because otherwise they won't make it for a 24 or 48 hour transport. So really, it's best eaten on in your own garden or in a friend's, and thrown into salads. And the salad can also have the herb in it. So like cilantro flowers would be delicious in a salad of cilantro and maybe chervil, which is another nice herb, and maybe some torn basil. And then also a more mild lettuce, like like a Boston lettuce, or bull's blood, or mescaline is that popular mix that everybody's getting now. It's kind of baby green, so it's nice to mix herbs into that.
Now, one of the things that was amazing is there is virtually no waste, or very little waste, on Eva's farm. What were some ways in which she salvaged stuff that you would have earlier thought was garbage or compost?
Yeah, I divide the book into four seasons, and each season has a kind of a principle that Eva lives by. So yeah, winter is salvaging, and Eva, I mean, I could tell you of the other day, she was so excited telling me about this, and this might be a little too much, but I just find her tenacity fascinating. She was making a delivery on, which normally she doesn't, she's 70 now, but she was making a delivery, and in the dumpster, she saw a big plastic container that was sealed, and she said, I want that plastic container. You know, it's being thrown out. It's perfectly good. I can use it at the farm, but it was full, and so she peeked in, and it was filled with salmon chunks, and she smelled it, and it wasn't bad, and so no. So this is where it might be going too far for most people, and I don't recommend this, but this is sort of dumpster diving. But she brought it home, and she cleaned the salmon thoroughly, and she cooked it up in a pressure cooker. And even I had some, and I thought it was great. So that's the kind of thing. That's an extreme example. Another example might be that she keeps venison in her fridge for 2 months in a brine, a marinade. And I'll sit there Googling, trying to figure out if that's okay, if that's possible, and usually it is. Usually the way Eva, extends the life of food is usually okay. And I've taken ServSafe classes, which are the, sanitation classes to open restaurants. So I've been circumspect for many years, and when she offers me a taste of her new soup, sometimes I'll say, what's in it, and how old were the ingredients, but I've gotten to the point now where I actually I enjoy it, and I know it's pretty safe. She really she's a true farmer. I mean, farmers don't make a lot of money, and so she's just crafty, and she it's almost like a badge of honor for her. She's just very proud of her salvaging prowess.
Well, on the one extreme, I think in this country you have a kind of ideology of sterility, which has made its way into a lot of codes around food and cooking and restaurants and stuff like that. I mean, no lone bacteria may make its way. And she's kind of on the other extreme. Like, those things are perfectly good. Like, there's one example in your book of how she was making a soup or something, and she poured in what she thought was vinegar, and then it turned out to be dishwashing liquid. It all frothed up. She just took everything out, washed it, and put it back.
Right. It's so true. I mean, I teach inner city kids. That's what I do. And I started a restaurant in a very, very, tough section of Boston. And, oh, my gosh, I learned, especially in people that don't have money, I think it becomes even more of a concern, possibly because of contamination is things are harder to control, and there's a lot of disadvantages to not having money, and maybe there's more rodents or whatever it is. I felt like I was being torn between two extremes, where I was trying to please the public that was very, very watching me like a hawk, making sure that I wasn't doing anything that would be unsafe while I made their sandwiches or whatever, and then Eva on the other end of the spectrum. And what's interesting is that cooking for little kids, which is what I do mostly, or cooking for teens, there's a lot of allergies, and there's also a lot of intolerance. They're not able to eat a wider array of food, and they'll get sick. I mean, even my boyfriend is like that. He can't have a whole lot of vegetables at one time because his digestive system can't take it. But what's happened with Eva is that, like many people in developing countries, her digestive system has strengthened to the point where she can eat food that has passed. And she'll serve food to other people, and they will get a queasy stomach or a bad stomach, but she won't, because she's strengthened her system.
How did your health or your digestion change eating so much at her farm, if it did?
Well, I say that, there's all this, slightly rancid food that she's serving, but really, for the most part, it's this incredibly fresh, organic, nutrient-dense plant food that we're eating most of the time. So the eating is about as healthy as the healthiest spa must aspire to. And What happens to me after 3 or 4 days is that I start to lose that little ripple in my belly that I normally have, you know, of fat. And then also I'll become more regular. You know, in the city where I live in Boston, you know, a lot of my diet is, as much as I don't want it to be, a lot of it is processed food like pasta and bread. And at Eva's, there's not much of that. So I feel terrific. It feels wonderful.
And it's mostly plants and then meat? Is that pretty much the diet that they have?
That's right. I mean, you know, she'll beg me to make some bread. But if I make bread, half of it will be from whole grains and the other half will be from ground, you know, like whole wheat flour. And then I'll use wheat berries or brown rice or something like that in the whole grain. So, yes, it's mostly plant food and fish or meat that's local and olive oil, nuts. But, yeah, I mean, there's over 100 herbs, so there's so much. And also there's local cheese, goat cheese. There's a lot of goat farms around her. So I'll make a pesto with a lot of different herbs, and I'll add some goat cheese and olive oil and garlic, and we'll eat that either on bread that I've just made, or we'll have that on a piece of fish, or we'll have it with some whole wheat pasta, or she's really into making grains. And for breakfast, she has a whole grain as her cereal. It will be hot or cold, but, you know, millet or quinoa or kasha or any kind of, you know, rye berry or wheat berry, she eats it in the morning like a cereal. So she eats a lot of grains, whole grains.
And is a very healthy person. It seems like not only does she not get sick, she barely gets tired.
Right. Oh, and for her milk, it's goat's milk. She really lately is drinking a lot of goat's milk. Oftentimes it's raw milk from the cow, but now it's goat's. And she makes her own kefir, and I've lived there for 3 months once, and I went to bed earlier than she did, and I woke up every morning later than she, you know, would wake up. And so I don't really understand how her energy is so high. She's very driven, she's, you know, slightly neurotic, but I like that because I am too. And she's just... I think she's just sort of, it partly is maybe diet, but I think she's just lifted by her passion for, you know, she's found what she loves. She loves doing what she does. She loves talking to the chef. She loves growing these beautiful greens, being in a setting that is really, you know, embracing nature. And I think she's found it for her. She's got her groove.
We're talking to Dee Dee Emmons about the book Wild Flavors, One Chef's Transformative Year Cooking from Eva's Farm. Now, you have been a chef or a cook or whatever you want to call it since you were a teenager. How did you get started? And what was your, tell us a little bit about your evolution as a chef.
Well, I used to get elbowed by my dad watching TV at night, and he'd say, oh, why don't you go and make that good hot fudge sauce that hardens on ice cream. You know, he'd like elbow me. And so I'd run off at, you know, age 10 or 11 and pick up the joy of cooking and make that fudge sauce. And then one thing led to the next. Then I was making him and my mom omelets on Sunday morning, surprising them with like a little flower in a vase, you know, in their, you know, breakfast in bed kind of thing. And then it moved to working at a cheese shop that was a really good cheese shop when I was 16. And then I went to college in New York City, and I majored in food management. And so it was a combination, really, of my mom and my dad. My dad lives to eat, and my mother loves to cook. And I think I just sort of fell under both of, you know, I fell under their spell, or I really caught the bug from them.
Now, do you still run a restaurant?
No, I don't. I have a couple of different jobs that I'm juggling, and I've just spent the last 15 years running and opening 4 different restaurants, but The last one is the nonprofit that I was explaining to you about, with the, you know, sanitation being a big issue. And now I've started a program from that nonprofit that's called Take Back the Kitchen, where I teach inner city youth. And there's three of us that are running the program. And then I'm also working with another nonprofit, working in public schools, working to make the food that they're dealt with, trying to bring it up a notch. So teaching cafeteria managers and their staff how to cook, and also we're collaborating on a cookbook, so that even around the whole U.S. has to deal with the same commodities that the government provides. So everybody's dealing with canned carrots and canned beans and chicken that's coming from the government. So I'm working on a cookbook that utilizes these commodities, and I think that's it. And then I do a lot of other teaching and consulting, and now I'm trying to promote the book, so that's part of it too, of my job. So I'm like juggling six jobs right now. It's very hard. I don't recommend it.
So I was looking through this book, and of course it's a great story, because Eva Somaripa is such a great character, but it also seems to me like a handbook to keep on hand for that moment when the sort of petroleum-based, soil-depleting agribusiness sector finally breaks down, which does seem to be kind of an inevitability. This is an example of how it's done in a sustainable way.
Yeah, I mean, this is a woman who's right, who's already prepared for that day, and how she lives and what her little trade secrets are about how she, you know, lives without much power at all. But she runs a commercial farm. It's not a home garden. But she lives off of that. And a lot of the book is sort of based on how you could do it at home, kind of a thing, because not everybody's going to start a commercial herb garden or herb farm. So it's about a woman who's been doing it, you know, because it's been her value system since she was 22 years old, and she's created a very quirky life, but yet it really incorporates so much of the community that it's not like she's off on a mountaintop and, you know, she doesn't have teeth and she's not talking to anybody. And this is like a woman who's incredibly popular in her neighborhood, yet she's living, you know, diametrically, opposed to the kinds of, you know, lives we have in terms of energy use and our diet. So, yeah.
Well, part of the energy use thing is, like, when you were staying there, she wouldn't even let you heat your room. So you were waking up and going to sleep in a frigid box.
And what I love about Eva is that she does not feel in the least bit bad about making you suffer. You almost feel like you're lucky. You're just lucky to be part of it all. I mean, it is such a gorgeous farm, and you are lucky to be eating such beautiful, fabulous food. But yeah, she doesn't make any apologies. You know, there's no heat on the second floor of the house, and she likes it that way. It's a nice, it's a better sleep. She'll tell you. I mean, you know, you sleep better when you're in a cold room. So she's just so certain about her values, and she's so passionate that she's just a perfect person to write about. And who knows, maybe there'll be a reality TV show. Some, you know, New York company will come in with cameras, and it'll be a huge hit, because she doesn't even flinch when the camera's in front of her. She's just kind of so focused on what she's doing, and she's in her world. There's just a certain confidence about her that's very infectious.
Dee Dee Emmons is the author of the book Wild Flavors, One Chef's Transformative Year Cooking from Eva's Farm, and it's about lots of different plants, recipes, seasons of the year, community, and lots of cooking tips and gadgets and much more than we could talk about. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.